just like a lot of places in North America where you have black bears and people, you're going to have some conflicts here and there. And the occasional, I encountered a bear, you know, some hiker encountering a bear along the AT or whatever, it's interesting for that person, but it, you know, it, there's no real pattern there. It just kind of happens, and life moves on. However, we have, in particular, in the Panthertown Valley area, which is a somewhat isolated piece of Forest Service land that's surrounded by residences in, near Cashers, North Carolina, that is very popular for hikers and campers. From multiple states, lots of people go there. It's kind of, some people refer to it as the Yosemite of the East because of the granite domes that are there. I don't know if you are familiar with it, but anyway, that area is very popular for campers. And over the last 3 years or so, we would get up until this year, prior to this year, we would get reports of bears getting into backpacks or tents or whatever in the Panthertown Valley area in very late winter, early spring. So there would be a time period from late February until about the 1st of April for the last several years where we would get a few reports, and then it would seemingly stop. That bear moved on or whatever, and but it got to be sort of a pattern there for a couple of years, but nothing unusual, nothing to be overly concerned with. But then this year, it started in February like it normally does, late February, and then it just kind of kept going. And we now we get reports just about every week, not necessarily every weekend that people are up there camping, but we do get these regular reports through the entire summer so far of people hanging their food. Generally speaking, they hang their food up, the bear climbs, it comes up to their campsite or that area, starts milling around, they try to run it off, usually by yelling or banging pots or, you know, the standard kind of passive ways of making a bear leave an area. And so, but the bear doesn't leave, and it winds up climbing the tree and essentially pulls the pack down, usually the cable. It gets the whole system down and then takes the pack off into the woods and does what bears do, rips it open and tries to eat the food. So what we decided is, because this situation now seems to have escalated to a point, it's just that we have more of these reports and they're going on for a longer period of time, and it's such a popular area for people, and it's great bear habitat. So we decided probably one of the solutions to pursue would be to require mandatory use of bear resistant containers in the Panthertown Valley. And because In the course of this discussion about Panthertown Valley, we do have places along the Appalachian Trail where we sometimes have chronic problems, and then they come and go. But we decided, well, since we're talking about this recreational area, let's talk about the Appalachian Trail at the same time and make it a dual proposal. Even though those are two different areas, they're not really related to each other geographically, but they do have some similar problems. They're very popular, obviously popular places for people to camp, and you have these bear incidences where bears learn. Once an individual bear learns that it can get food out of a backpack, it's hard to break it of that habit. And so we figured if we institute this requirement for bear-resistant containers, that would go a long way towards kind of smoothing all that over and maybe dispersing these bears more.
Gotcha. Is there a reason we're seeing more bears, or are the bears just getting like, oh, I got this, smarter? Any reason for the uptick in bear sightings and interactions?
I think generally speaking, and you can ask a lot of wildlife biologists this question, and they'll tell you pretty much the same thing. In eastern North America, and in particular, the eastern portion of North America, from Maine all the way down into Florida, bear populations have, by and large, increased over the last several decades. I mean, we've seen there's something to be said for the mature oak hickory forest coming back after the turn of the 20th century. A lot of these mountains were just logged. If they could get to it, they clear cut the whole mountain. And so that might have made a lot of blackberries and blueberries, but it wasn't great for acorns and hickory nuts. And so there was a time period way back when bear populations were very low, but we've seen the recovery of the oak hickory forest, both on public land, like Forest Service or Park Service, and on private land. And so that food source, the in particular the acorns that are produced sporadically, even though they don't produce every year, but they do produce an important food source for bears. And so that has changed in the broad scale, but in the kind of closer to home, all the individual states that have bear populations have hunting seasons with seasonal restrictions and bag limits and effective law enforcement from poaching. And so there's just a lot of factors that have gone into an increasing bear population. Again, not just in western North Carolina, but in a lot of places. And so that's kind of what we're looking at on the broad scale. But in Panthertown Valley, in my opinion as a bear biologist, as a wildlife biologist generally, I used to be a bear biologist back in the day, but now I'm a kind of more of a generalist with the Forest Service. But in my opinion, in my experience with bears, I think what we have going on in Panthertown Valley in particular is that we have one or two or three, you know, some small number of bears. There's many bears probably use that area for their as part of their home range at some point of their life, and then within the year or another, they're going to be in that Panthertown Valley area. But there's probably a couple of bears that use it almost exclusively, and so these bears or bear, it could just be one, but I suspect it's a couple. They have just learned that it's real easy to climb a tree and pull a backpack down or pull the string that's holding the backpack between two trees down. And so it's a learned behavior. It's just like when a bear learns that it can flip a rock, or it learns from its mother, it can flip a rock over and get some ant larvae. Or if it learns it rips a log apart, it can get some beetle grubs, maybe a couple of salamanders. They get a reward from that. From that physical exertion. And they figured out, too, if I climb this tree and pull a backpack down, it's probably got lots of food calories in it. And so once a bear learns a particular skill, if you want to call it a skill, it's aggravating for us, but it's a skill to them. Once they learn that skill, they're not going to forget it. And they don't forget those food sources. And so they don't really see that as your food or my food when it's hanging in that tree. They see it as fair game. And nobody seems to own it, and there's no large 375-pound male bear standing underneath that tree to defend it, and so it's theirs as far as they're concerned. And so that's kind of what's going on here. And what we, the Forest Service, are trying to do is break that cycle. If we can get make this mandatory or some version of it, of this proposal, if we make that mandatory and everybody complies with it, all the human campers are complying with it, then we stand a pretty good chance of that bear or bears kind of just giving up and going about their business, what they should be doing in a natural, more natural behavior pattern. That's what we're hoping for. It doesn't always work. These things are very hard to institute and maintain over time, but it's certainly worth trying. And we might actually affect real change. So that's kind of what we're looking at there.
Can you describe what is a bear-resistant food container?
I can generally. I don't want to recommend any brands, so we avoid that. That's up to the consumer, the camper who's, you know, thinking about going camping, to choose what they want or to pay the price they're willing to pay or whatever. But that's up to them. So if I mention any brands or whatever, I'm not endorsing them in any way. It's just an example, maybe. So a bear resistant container, most of those in general are hard. It's a hard, like a polycarbonate or whatever type plastic that's very shatter resistant. The good ones, the ones that we would recommend, they've been rated by an organization called the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee, which basically looks at things like this. Like, you know, you can buy a cooler. One of those expensive rototurn coolers, usually those get rated if it passes the test anyway. They put them in, they put these coolers, they fill them with fruit and all this other stuff, and they put them in a facility that has bears in captivity, and these bears are hungry, and they don't feed them for a little while, and so the bear's motivated to get into that cooler or that garbage can or whatever it might be, and so it tries to defeat the mechanism that's protecting that food, and if it passes a certain battery of tests with those bears, these live, real bears, then it gets approved by that interagency grizzly bear committee as being bear resistant, not bear proof. Nothing's bear proof, but you might find that one bear that can get into something or break it or whatever. But generally speaking, though, if it's bear resistant, it's probably going to, if it's used properly, it will be. And so so these canisters or these containers tend to be hard sided. It's sort of like a plastic jar, if you will. But they have mechanisms on them that makes it hard for a bear to get in them. And they're built with materials that makes it hard for the bear to break. And so, you know, just going to a store and buying a plastic container that you think is airtight, and it may not be as airtight as you believe it to be, that's probably not going to fly. It won't work. And so, you want it to be, you want some authority to say, yeah, this container has been rated as bear resistant. And some of them are soft-sided. Some of them are more like a sack. And I think the main material for them might be Kevlar or whatever. But the idea here is the bear might get a hold of this object that has all of your camper's backpacker meals in it, and your toothpaste and your chewing gum and all that stuff that you've got stored in that container. It knows that there's something in there. It just can't get to it. And that kind of breaks that cycle of, well, if I get a backpack, I'm going to get at least a meal out of it. Well, if he or she is not getting rewarded, then they're going to give up, slap that thing off to the side, and walk away. And that, you know what I'm saying? It breaks that cycle. So that's kind of
right.
That's the idea behind them. And as far as sources, I guess I should kind of follow that up with, well, where do you get one of these things? There's a lot of different sources that you can order them from, and generally, you know, if you look at and again, without promoting anybody, you go to these big box store, these big outdoor stores, pretty much any one of them. Now, they may be out of stock on a particular Saturday you go in there, if you go into one of these big outdoor stores, but they might, you know, you might be able to order them online, or you can order them through some of the other companies that sell things that you can buy just about anything online anymore. And so there are ways to get them. Some of the smaller, like the more local sporting goods stores in a particular, that's only in that particular town, they may have them, they may not, or they may be able to order them just like anybody else. And so that's kind of the source for these things. You don't want to really build your own or try to come up with some, and I like to do this, personally, I like to find things, and well, I could, you know, I can't afford the high end thing, but I could make my own or come up with something that's a replacement for the more expensive item. You really want these things to be, if you're going to do it, you want it to be, you want to have the confidence that it's going to do what it's supposed to do. Otherwise, you haven't really accomplished anything.
Is this? I mean, in Asheville, you know, we're dealing with the whole phenomenon of urban bear. So, I mean, it's just Western North Carolina is an interesting place in that each sort of pocket has its own black bear challenges.
Right. Yeah. You know, and depending on where you are in North America, you could go to Northern Ontario and start bushwhacking through the forest and come across a bear, and that bear is going to just get away from you as quick as it can. Or it may just look at you and go, I don't even know what you are, you know, and go about its business. As long as it doesn't feel threatened by you, but in like you're saying, in these urban and suburban areas that there's sort of an interface of wild habitat and human habitat, and it all kind of meshes together, and so these bears have natural food sources, again, things like ants and yellow jackets. I mean, they dig up yellow jacket nests and eat the grubs, the larvae, the young larvae. And, of course, they're getting stung by yellow jackets. You and I, there's no way you could tolerate that kind of pain. But a bear does it regularly. It's not unusual. Bumblebees, yellow jackets, they dig them up. Ants, beetle grubs, grass, I mean, they eat all kinds of things. And, of course, acorns and fruits. But at the same time, in an area like Asheville, they also have garbage cans and bird feeders and the dog food that you poured out for your dog last night, but the dog didn't eat it because it's already got enough food. But the bear comes along, and along with the possums and the raccoons and the squirrels and everything else, well, the bears are going to take advantage of those calories as well. And so they get kind of used to being around people. These wildland urban interface bears, they don't mind at all. I mean, I worked on a bear research project years ago in Virginia where, I mean, we would go and we would do telemetry on bears and we'd figure out where they were denning, and we would have a female bear who's pregnant at the time who winds up giving birth to her cubs underneath somebody's porch that they didn't even know she was there because it was a part of the yard they didn't go down into, and she'd be right there or in the blackberry thicket, literally right next to the porch. And these people would come out on their deck and have picnics, and the kids would throw the ball around in the yard, and there's this bear curled up with her cubs just yards, feet sometimes away from them. And so they just get they feel comfortable there. It's not that dangerous. Nobody's really messing with them. And so they can get very used to people. And what we would rather see is that in these, especially in these backcountry camping areas, and this is not an established campground that we're talking about in Panthertown. It's dispersed camping in a backcountry setting. There's no organized, people kind of, so there is one shelter there. It's like a camping shelter, but by and large, it's not a campground. And so there's not like a picnic table and a fire pit, you know, sort of situation. It's just wherever somebody goes in there and decides to camp is where they camp. And so in those situations, you would hope that the bears are a little more wary of people and don't see people as a potential source of food in terms of their backpacks full of snacks and that sort of thing. And so, but as long as they're getting that reward, it's going to kind of continue. And that's what we're trying to break, that cycle. It's an extremely difficult cycle to break because we all want those calories. And from your typical bear, they don't care where they get the calories from as long as they get them. It could be a rotten deer carcass. It could be the garbage in the, and you know, we walk up to a dumpster and you catch a whiff of that dumpster and your human mind says, get away, do not eat that, it's bad. But a bear has no compunction. I mean, they're going to eat it because there are calories in that rotten food. They're going to get it where they can get it, because if they don't fatten up, if they don't get enough fat by November, they may not make it through until the next April, and it's life or death for them. We don't think about that sometimes, but it is life or death for the bear. They're going to get the food where they need to get it from.
Right. If you, and I, it says this nicely in the press release that was sent, but if you do encounter a bear, and most of us, you know, have in neighborhoods and shoo-shoo or making a noise, clanging pots and pans, but for campers who may not know what the right steps, tips for an encounter with a bear.
Generally speaking, when a bear is comfortable enough to come into a campsite, for example, or your yard for that matter, this really applies across the range of situations, typical situations. If a bear's that comfortable, it has probably been rewarded before in similar circumstances. And so if you wake up or you come around the tent and there's a bear in your campsite, if you slap your hands real hard or bang two pots together and go, get out of here, and that bear immediately runs and doesn't come back, well, that's probably a bear that just bumped into you, didn't know what was going on, and really doesn't want to be interacting with people. But if the bear doesn't leave, if it just kind of looks at you and goes about its business, maybe nervously, sometimes you can tell they'll pace a little, they might huff and puff a little bit, blow, and they just make certain noises and movements that indicate that they're nervous, but they still stay, that bear is going to be a little bit more difficult in terms of turning it and getting it to leave the area, because it knows whatever they think of us, whether they think of us as strange looking bears or whatever, you know, it's hard to say what they think of human beings, but You know, they look at us and go, I don't know about this thing that's making these loud noises at me, but I hear loud noises all the time, trees falling in the woods, thunder and lightning and, you know, distant gunshots and rocks falling off of mountains, and those things never hurt me, so why should I worry about this human, you know, that's yelling and banging those loud metal pots at me? That doesn't mean anything to me. Bears, when you're just talking about bears, whether it's black bears here in the east or grizzly bears and black bears in the west, when in the bear world, when you have a food source, I don't care if it's a berry patch or a salmon stream or a garbage dump, what bears are going to do, they're going to be attracted to that food source, and they're going to look at each other, and again, in the absence of any human competition or the presence of humans in that particular situation at a given time, these bears are going to look at each other, they're going to size each other up, they're going to communicate to each other how comfortable they are in terms of their spacing. And you see it on those documentaries. You look at Katmai Falls or whatever in Alaska, and there's lots of bears there because the salmon are coming in. You have big males, you have females with cubs, you have yearling animals that have been, or 2 or 3 year old bears that have been kicked out of their mom's home range, and they're all trying to get along. But you know, the bigger you and badder you are, the better spot you get, and at that food source, whatever it is. And so everybody else has to make their living on the edges of that guy's little spot. And so that's how bears see the world. If somebody's not actively willing to bring pain on me, I'm going to walk in and get that food, whether it's blueberries or a backpack or whatever. And so slapping and clapping and yelling and air horns and stuff don't necessarily mean any real trouble to a bear. Whereas if a large male gets after you, you better run or he might kill you. And so sometimes they just don't fear those things like we think they should, like a dog would. I mean, we almost expect a dog type reaction from a bear, and they don't necessarily see it that way. They see you as just, well, they probably want some of this delicious food that I'm smelling too, but if I play my cards right, I'll be able to get my chance at it. And as an example of that, if you don't mind, when I was a state biologist in Virginia, I would get reports there'd be 6 or 7 or 8 bears one of those trash collection sites, with these open top dumpsters, that people, and sometimes people would feed the bears on purpose there too, just to be able to watch them, which is not a good idea. But even without that, there's plenty of temptation. And I would show up and there would be a bear, and one particular bear, I'm trying to get rid of this bear to make it go away. It's getting a little too bold around people that come to drop trash off. And I would shoot that bear with rubber projectiles that cause a lot of pain but don't kill the animal. And so I would shoot that bear and I would watch it, and I'd yell and, you know, make all this dramatic noise and stuff. The bear would run up away from me, go up to the edge of the woods and kind of look back and circle back around, and it would come back relatively close to me but a little bit further away than it was before, because it thought that I was just defending my part of the garbage dump. That's all it figured. If it stayed far enough away from me, that it could still eat without getting any trouble with me. And that's just the way they think. I mean, that's how it works in the bear world. Why wouldn't it work with people? And that's what we're running into is, you know, you just can't get that message. It's very difficult for a camper. You know, you could pepper spray a bear potentially that's getting in your backpack. If you can deploy the spray and it works and it gets in the bear's nose, it might run it off for a while, but the food's still going to be sitting there. And if you go back to your tent, well, you've stopped defending the food. And so the bear's going to come back. It might wait an hour or so, but it'll come back and think, well, he went to bed, so I guess I can eat. I mean, the food's still there. The temptation's still there. And it's very, very difficult. And sometimes you can put those backpacker electric fences up. Those are getting pretty popular in Alaska and Canada, where you have grizzly bear or brown bear issues. Brown bear is just a bigger version of a grizzly bear. They're all the same species. But still, I mean, those electric backpacker fences sometimes work. Nothing's 100% foolproof, but those things have been shown to work pretty well. People camp inside of them or store their food inside of them. And that is a constant electrical reminder to a bear that if you touch this thing, you're going to get pain. And they just don't like that pain, especially from electricity. It just totally freaks them out. and confuses them, and they don't know how to handle it. As opposed to yellow jackets stinging them, they just don't know what it, where it, you know, they can't handle it, so they really don't like it. And so, but it's very difficult to find something that gives that constant reminder to stay away from this stuff that you really want for campers. Very difficult. But again, that we would have to have something in place that works, and then we would have to have generally, and again, you're talking people from all walks of life, from all kinds of places, and some of which, some people have more understanding of bear behavior than others. You have to get high compliance across the board and through time, because all it takes for one bear that hasn't even been born yet to be born and kind of get out on its own, or maybe even learn from its mother that, hey, backpacks mean food, you know, and that's all it takes is a couple of times for them, just like a dog with treats. You can train them to do all kinds of interesting and complicated things because they want that food reward. And it may not be much of a reward. It may not be many calories, but it's a tasty treat for them, and they're willing to do whatever they need to do to get it. And that's the way bears are in that respect. And so if you can keep that situation relatively reward-free, then you have a much better chance of accomplishing that.
God, it's so interesting. How long have you been studying bears, and then how did you land in where you're in the district where you are now?
Oh, wow. Well, I've worked all over North America. I started when I was young, in the mid-90s, I was at the University of Georgia, worked a few jobs, different wildlife jobs here and there. But the first bear project that I actually worked on was in Virginia in 1997. It was a long-term research project west of the Shenandoah Valley in the Allegheny Mountains. And so I went to work there for Virginia Tech, and I was as a technician. So I worked there for a couple of years, and I was trying to get into graduate school. But we did we worked bears up in their dens. We caught them in the summertime and put radio collars on them, tracked them around, looked at their food studies, and we looked at, you know, their home range sizes, all that different stuff. And then I got a graduate project of my own in the Dismal Swamp, which is part of which is in North Carolina, part of it's in Virginia. And so so I worked on bears there, and then from there I went to work for various state wildlife agencies. I worked for Arizona Game and Fish, where I dealt with nuisance bear issues there and just general bear issues. Then I worked for Virginia Game and Fish for a decade, and again, just almost constant bear issues that we had there. And again, sometimes on Forest Service land, but mainly on people's private land. And so I dealt with those issues there. And then with the Forest Service, when I went to work for the Forest Service 3 years ago, I went to Alaska, which there are many, many bears in Alaska. And where we were, it was only black bears, but there were brown bears nearby on the mainland. But and then I wound up spending a year in Alaska and then came to North Carolina to work on the Nantahala. So it's been a couple of decades of bear work of some sort or another, sometimes more intensive than others. I don't do that much with bears anymore until we did this press release, and now I think I'm going to be doing this for a few weeks, pretty solid, dealing with the questions. And that's fine. I'm just saying that it's not a big part of my job typically to deal with bears now, because the Forest Service manages habitat. We don't manage animals per se. That's a state wildlife agency responsibility in all the various states you want to talk about. The state manages the wildlife. The Forest Service on Forest Service property manages wildlife habitat in some way or another. And then that's what we're basically, in a way, we're trying to manage habitat here. And in that, if we institute this requirement, and then people comply with it, we've kind of shunted the bear's behavior generally back towards natural food sources. So it's a habitat thing in an indirect.
Super. And just to clarify, if you could just, I know you said this at the beginning of the interview, but just the area you're seeking input, the two areas this will impact.
It's going to apply to the Appalachian Trail that travels through the Nantahala and Pisgah National Forest, because the Appalachian Trail, that as it passes through North Carolina, it goes through the Appalachian Ranger District, which is on the Pisgah National Forest, and then it also travels through the Nantahala, Chioa, and Tuskwhittie Ranger Districts of the Nantahala National Forest. So that area is the anybody camping on the AT as it goes through North Carolina, that this requirement would be there as enacted, and then in Panthertown Valley, which is a separate area geographically from the Appalachian Trail, but it's a piece of Forest Service land that is near Cashers and Highlands, North Carolina, relatively close to Cashers.